my name's Katie Leeson and I'm Managing Director of Social Chain UK, and joining me this week I have an incredibly special guest, actress Gemma Oton. You will know Gemma from her roles in Emmerdale and Holby City, but what you won't know about Gemma is that she got into acting to escape her personal life. Bullied at a young age, she developed anorexia and an eating disorder, which she carried with her for 13 years. And in this podcast, we discuss her journey with her eating disorder, her psychiatric unit experiences that she was just 12 years old when she went into, how she's left a abusive relationship 2 years ago, and now her amazing work with her charity, Seed, and how she's helping to change education and information around eating disorders. There are tears in this podcast. It's highly emotional, and I really can't wait for you to listen to it. So sit back, relax, get the tissues ready for this very emotional episode of I Shouldn't Say This But. Thank you so much for joining me today. We met, didn't we, in the summer?
Yeah.
At a training conference.
Women in Leadership Summit, yes. I think, was the official line.
That is.
And at Werburn.
Yes, and we played a bit of golf. We didn't know why we were there, though, did we? No one knew.
No, it was really, it was a bit odd, but then it kind of became clear. Yeah. Did you feel like that?
Yeah.
I was kind of like, what are we all on this train and then all getting carted off to this hotel and then this, that. But then once we got in the room and we all started talking and sharing our stories, and I think one of the key things that I took from that, and I don't know if it was Jane who said it, she said, lift as you climb. Mm. And I was just like, oh my God, I get this now. Mm. And then Sarah Sterk, who had organised it, it was all about collaborate to accelerate. And I think for me, like Haley had said about it as well, like all these names thrown around, but they'll know who they are, about how we'd grown up as being lasses.
Yeah.
You know, not really around females or not really close to many girlfriends, grew up with the lads, and how that two-day summit really changed both of our lives in a massive way. So it was amazing.
It was.
Yeah.
It was. And we're all come with that close. Like, everyone's from such different backgrounds, and work that we do is all different. But one of my big things is you can't be what you can't see. Mm. And just being in that room with so many women that have achieved so much, it was like, yeah, we're doing it. We're going to make a difference. So
no, it was amazing. It really was.
So the first thing that I want to do with you really is we've got a bit of a game. Taken from the game, We're Not Really Strangers. And it's a series of questions that two people who've only just met, even though we haven't, are supposed to ask each other. And we thought it'd be a great way to start.
Right.
So these are picked randomly because it's a pack of cards and we've just picked them. So the first one, and it goes up in levels. So it starts off like lighthearted and then gets a little bit deeper. So the first one, level one, who in your life can you be most vulnerable with?
My parents. I know that's a collective, but they come as a package. Definitely mum and dad. They've seen me, warts and all, at my lowest, at the worst version of me, at the best version of me. I really am lucky to have such amazing parents who just accept me for who I am. And if anything, if I'm struggling with anything, they are my rock, they are my port of call. And it's a really unique bond that we've got, but I think, and we'll probably go into it, but because of what we went through as a family, it's very, very special what we have. And sometimes there are fireworks in the worst way, and sometimes there are amazing fireworks in the best way. But yeah, I can definitely say that I'm able to be my most vulnerable with them.
Great. That wasn't really lighthearted, was it? I realised that when we started going into it. Second, level two, what belief about yourself no longer serves you?
Ooh, that I'm weak. I spent many, many years feeling weak, physically and mentally. Mm. And even though there was always a resilience and a fight in me, there was still this other side of me that just felt so frail, fragile, diminished, and it's definitely not a thought that enters my head anymore. It doesn't serve me any purpose whatsoever. To think that I can't is never an option anymore.
Nice, nice. Great thing to live by. Can't is not an option. And then level three, the final one of this is, what's your favourite part of yourself that isn't physical?
Ooh. My authenticity.
Nice.
I think what you see is what you get with me. And I've always worn my heart on my sleeve to my detriment at times. But also it's made amazing things happen. I think one thing I've always prided myself on is that I've never changed for any purpose or for any reason. I've always stayed true to myself. So yeah, I think my authenticity is something that I really am proud of.
Yeah, and you should be. It's such a great trait to have. Yes, I like that one. So we'll start now with your story and talk about the incredible story, because your life has been a lot of highs and lows, and I want you to talk about it. But you said you suffered anorexia for 13 years, which is a long time. It started at the age of 10. Can you explain to the listeners about that period in your life and the experiences? I'd also like to know a little bit, because you've said you've been in a psychiatric unit, and what life was like when you were there, and a little bit, because I know you also had a heart attack in your teens as well. Just explain to the listeners your journey, if that's okay.
Yeah, might be a long one. I've grown up in Hull, and two sisters and a brother, wonderful mum and dad, grandparents, life was great. Very, very happy. I always remember thinking, like, if this is what life is, this is awesome. Like, so happy. And, you know, I was very fortunate in terms of my skill sets. I was good at sport, my acting, singing, academic-wise. You know, I had a reading age of 16 at the age of 8, something ridiculous. Wow. You know, I was thriving and loving life, but I was also a bit of a tomboy. So there'd be all the girls out in the gingham dresses and the pigtails, and I'd be the one sort of running around the playground with the lads, playing block and alley-alley-o and you know, football, and wearing my awful red trainers, Dunlop trainers and shorts, and but not caring, just being so free. And it kind of felt like overnight everything changed. And this sounds really strange, but I got my hair cut into a slightly girlier style, because I used to look a bit like Jim Carrey from Dumb and Dumber with the little bowler hat haircut. And often would get mistaken for a little lad, you know, and didn't bother me. And I used to dress like my dad. Me and dad would be like twins. But I got my hair cut into a more girly style. And I remember going to school the next day, and one of the girls sort of looked at me and she went, "Oh, why have you got your hair cut?" And I was like, "Why not?" And then another girl was like, "Oh my God, that looks gorgeous. You look really nice." And then the lads sort of, it didn't happen overnight, but in my head, this is how I remember it. Then the lads who were friends were all of a sudden, kiss chase was starting to happen in the playground, and I was developing quite quickly. I was noticing that I was getting hairs on my legs, and things were happening here, like getting little breasts, and growth, like starting to develop into a woman. And my mum had always been amazing, like in terms of really talking me through puberty and the changes in my body and how to embrace it, and always made me feel proud. But then as my progression as a young girl was becoming into a young woman, and my skill sets were excelling as well, unfortunately, the green-eyed monster came in from the girls. And that's when the bullying started. And I just felt like my whole world was changing so fast, and I couldn't grasp why people were saying the things that they were saying and why behaviours were changing towards me. Mm. And I remember starting to feel more and more isolated. And it was all words, which was so difficult, because I often say I wish the bullies would hit me, because then it would be a physical pain that I could actually talk about, but I just couldn't articulate what was going on.
Yeah.
And I started to retreat into myself. You know, I'd always been very bubbly and outgoing and, you know, loved all the teachers. And I was very good with adults as well because I'd grown up with, you know, older siblings. And I started to feel like the only friends I had were my parents or the teachers. So it was like feeling so isolated in the playground. Anyway, long story short, I started to feel disgusting and I started to feel fat. And I actually have no idea where that thought came from. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't look in a magazine and see a model and think, oh, I want to look like that. Like, I was reading Dandy and Beena and I definitely didn't want to grow a beard. But I really started to become aware of my body and hated it. And in hindsight, at the time, I didn't understand why I was doing what I was doing. But in hindsight, I didn't understand it then. I was very, very lost and confused. But in hindsight, I think I couldn't control what people were saying or doing, but I could control what went inside me. Mm. And also in my head, the less of me there was, the less of me there was for people to hate and hurt. And also losing weight meant losing my figure. It meant my period stopping. This was later down the line, obviously, but retreating back into a little girl that was happy. Mm. Mum and Dad took me to the doctor when they first sort of spotted the warning signs, because I love food. Like, I grew up, like, family meals were on the table at 5 o'clock. Mum was an amazing cook, just ate everything. And then, obviously, Mum and Dad quickly spotted that I was saying that I'd eaten at a friend's house and coming home and saying I didn't want my tea or coming home and not finishing the plate, which I'd never normally do. So they sat me down and they said to me, look, Gem, we think you're developing an eating disorder. And I at first was like, no, I don't know what that is. I don't know, that's wrong. I'm not stupid. Like, I wouldn't do that. And then very quickly bursting out into tears and saying, I have no idea what's going on in my mind right now. I have absolutely no idea why I can't stop thinking about how disgusting and fat I am. So they took me to the doctor and the doctor weighed me and she said, there's nothing to worry about. She's not low enough in weight. It's just a phase. Like, just keep an eye on it. Don't worry. And I remember feeling so ashamed. I felt such a failure. I felt pathetic and I felt weak. So we got turned away, no help offered. And then literally within a year or two, I was on my deathbed, told that if I didn't eat or drink within 24 hours, I'd be dead. And I was put in a wheelchair and wheeled across from an assessment that we'd been waiting months for and put into a psychiatric unit, an adolescent psychiatric unit. And it was the scariest thing. It didn't feel real.
Mm.
I remember being sat in that room. And up until that point, Mum and Dad were literally keeping me alive every night. They were wrapping me up in as many layers as they could because my body temperature was so low. Hot water bottles. Dad and Mum would be in my bedroom every half an hour to check I was still breathing. Mum would be rubbing Vaseline on my bed sores because my body was skeletal. They were having to do that without any help or support. So when I went into that meeting to be assessed, you could see the look of horror on their faces, the professionals' faces. And even I was like, still blinkered. It wasn't a reality for me. I didn't know why they were looking like that. I really didn't think I was that bad.
Mm.
But it's a shock to the system when all of a sudden you're talking about what's going on to the next not going home again for 6 months and being put into a room and basically being force-fed and challenged and isolated. I couldn't see my family. Mum and Dad were allowed to see me, but I couldn't see my siblings.
For 6 months?
For the first 2 months at least.
Wow.
They had this system of reward. If I put weight on, I could have a bath on my own. If I put a pound on, I could maybe watch television for an hour. If I put another pound on, I was allowed to wash my hair. It was that intense, but it was also that ridiculous because I was eating 4 cornflakes a day and drinking a sherry glass of water. I'd gone from that to then putting a burger, chips a bowl of soup and a pudding in front of me, which is not only ludicrous, but it's really dangerous. Mm. Like, to feed somebody like that is insane. And this is, you know, I've got to say, this is like, gosh, 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, 23 years ago, but still, there was no concept of understanding what I needed to be treated.
Mm.
So there was no talk of what was going on inside my mind. Like, an eating disorder is a mental health illness. Like, no one was trying to get to the root of it. So I was literally just on my bed every day having these battles every single mealtime. I wasn't integrated with the other kids there at the time. But eventually when I did start to put weight on, I was allowed to go down into the daycare room, which was a whole different ball game. I wasn't in an eating disorder unit. I was in a psychiatric unit. So I was all of a sudden amongst people that were frightening to me. I vividly remember one lad who was there who was schizophrenic, and he would often go off on a whim and throw things and scream and shout and kick and punch. And I eventually shared a room with a girl who used to self-harm, and she would sit on the end of my bed. And this is at the age of 12 years old. Like, I'm being subjected to all of this. It was just, it was a really horrible, horrible time. And mum and dad eventually took me out of that unit. The one thing happened where the lad had gone into a rage and he'd thrown the stereo. And back in those days, you can remember the big guys, and he'd thrown it at my head. And we'd all been told to go into this room, and he got put into another room, but it was one of the therapy rooms. So there was the mirror, so he couldn't see us, but we could see him, and we could see him being injected with sedation. And I remember telling mum and dad this story, and it kind of become the norm for me. I was just like, oh, you won't believe what happened last night. And mum and dad were just like, this can't happen anymore. So they took me out, but again, there wasn't the resource that was needed. CAMHS, unfortunately, really, really struggle. The Children and Adolescent Mental Health Service, and I don't want to get political, but the government do not give CAMHS and the NHS enough money to deal with mental health illnesses, especially eating disorders. Things are getting better, but they're still not great. So again, I was on waiting lists and referrals, and then, you know, put into therapy, but that wasn't working. I stayed well for a time. Mum and dad did the best that they could do, but then it became just the norm that every few weeks I'd be in hospital on a drip.
So hard for your parents as well, because how do they know how to deal with it if the medical professions aren't, like, helping either, and it's not addressing, like, the mental side of it?
Yeah.
How are your parents meant to know how to help you? It must have been, like, just horrific for all of you at that time.
Yeah,
and helpless as well. Everyone must have felt very helpless.
God, I mean, the thing is, you've got to remember, mum and dad didn't just have one child, they had four. And I do feel, and I shouldn't say this, but I know my siblings resented me for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I know they love me, but I know they couldn't understand it. They did not understand why I was doing what I was doing. And they lost their parents for a long time during that period too. And going back to what you were saying about how did mum and dad know how to help me, well, the arguments and World War III situations that went on were horrific, because, you know, you can imagine they were desperate. But then what happened, and I found it completely and utterly bonkers that mum would suggest this at the time, but mum is mum, and I can now see she did the most amazing thing. She decided that she was going to... Well, mum and dad had obviously started to do research for themselves. They were reading every single book on eating disorders. They were trying to reach out to professionals and experts who could help them. So they started to educate themselves in order to help me.
Mm.
But then it came to a point where, yet again, we'd been turned away for funding for some help that I needed to get into an eating disorder unit. And mum was like, right, I am setting up a helpline. I'm setting up a charity. I'm not having any parent go through what we're going through. And Seed was born. Seed was support and empathy for eating disorders. And her and dad just decided that they were going to make a difference. And at the time, I was in hospital, and I remember it not sitting well with me, actually.
Mm.
Because we were going through a battle.
Yeah.
With each other as well as with ourselves. Mm. And then mum's all of a sudden going to help other people.
Mm.
Like, I'm ashamed to say it, but I was like, but you're my mum. Mm. Like, you should be there for me, but we're arguing and we're shouting at each other. Like, why are you giving your time to other people? Like, I couldn't.
Yeah.
But actually, looking back on it, mum needed to do this because I believe she felt that helpless with me, that she needed an outlet and to help other people, which in turn came full circle because then our relationship did change and she started to be able to help me better as well.
Because she understood it from...
Yeah. So, and then we became a registered charity in 2004, I think it was. And the journey carried on for 13 years. Like, we could be here for all day talking about it. But, you know, I was shoved in and out of eating disorder units. That didn't help me. It was just a case of feeding everyone up and then shipping them out.
Mm.
And it quickly became clear that that wasn't helping me. And then when I had the heart attack in my late teens, that was a real wake-up call as well in terms of how scary it was, but also how something needed to change. And so that's when I went into really intense therapy. So I was still living at home, but I would go and see my therapist 2 or 3 times a week. And that's where the real work sort of started to begin. And the other big wake-up call for me was when my best friend killed himself when I was in one of the eating disorder units as well. Mm. That was a real turning point in terms of going, right, I am sat at his funeral at 19 years old. I am seeing the devastation that his death has caused, not that he wanted to cause anybody any pain. He was in pain.
Mm.
But it made me realise that I was doing exactly the same thing, Lee, as what Lee had done, but in a much slower, much more painful way, because it was very visible to my family. And that's when I sort of really took the brave step of wanting to recover, because recovery is the hardest part of an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when you've only known that way of life for 13 years. And this is why we always say, like, early intervention is key.
Yeah.
Like, the sooner you can help somebody who's starting to show the signs of an eating disorder, the sooner we can bring that person back.
Mm.
You know, and I did a TEDx last year, and in my talk, like I say, about how...
So proud of you for that, by the way, because I knew it was a big, big deal, wasn't it? Oh,
it was the scariest thing I've ever done, aside from any Emmerdale Live episode or theatre or anything, you know, to get up and say words that I'd created and put together and something that was so important. But to stand there and you know, say, like, waiting for the weight to change isn't going to stop what's already there, and the longer we wait, the more expensive it's going to be to bring that person back, and expensive in every sense of the word, expensive on their life and on resource. And that's why I'm so passionate about SEED and just talking until people listen. Mm. And even if they don't listen, somebody might listen who is suffering and who needs our help.
Yeah.
So that's that, really.
An incredible journey. And I think that time that you were going through all that, for me, it was one of those periods in my life where I was learning who I was as a person. So for you to have that much, like, unease and unrest in your family life and your health and everything, it must have taken you a long time to realise who Gemma was, I think, probably.
Gosh, yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah. I came to a realisation this year that I didn't really live. Like, this is the first decade where I haven't been in hospital. Sorry, the last decade that just gone has been the first one that I hadn't been in hospital or nearly died. I had to get to 25 to live. Mm. And that really struck me. And I remember when I did start to recover and I got better and I was well enough to apply for drama school. And when I got in when I was 24, I think it was, I didn't know how to live.
Mm.
Like, I remember Mum writing me a booklet, God love her, how to do the washing, how to, you know, like, look after the flat that I was living in when I was going to drama school. Like, it was a real leap of faith. And even when I got to drama school, I still didn't know who I was. I had no idea what I was about. But what I did know is that I was fighting still.
Mm.
I was fighting for everything. And the intensity that I brought to drama school actually got me where I needed to be, but it was also a period of learning. And I only think I'm really starting to understand who I am in the last 2 years, in all honesty. Learning to lose that intensity,
mm.
like that, because people with eating disorders, they're perfectionists by trait. Like, I'm not saying everyone is, but it's a common factor of somebody who is suffering from an eating disorder, perfectionist, that put pressure on themselves, they're a high achiever.
Mm.
And even when I got to the point where I'd got Emmerdale, which was in 2011, I remember going on set and I would know that script inside out, back to front. Everything would be color-coded. Everything would be labeled. Like, I could do a cartwheel. I could stand on my head and say my lines. And I'd go on set with James Houghton, who played Sam Dingle, and sometimes he wouldn't even know what scene we were doing. but it was a brilliant partnership because he taught me how to start enjoying. And I taught him how to start being a little bit more, not that he wasn't grateful for the job, but he'd been there for so long that it had just become part and parcel. And so we met in the middle, and that was a real learning curve. And it was something that I've explored over the last few years, especially this last year, about how life isn't an emergency, it's an adventure. And to remember to take those moments, and also for me to remember I don't have to prove myself to anyone anymore. I've already proved it. Yeah. I'm alive.
Yeah.
So the last 2 or 3 years of really starting to figure out who I am. And I think when we met, actually, I asked the question about boundaries. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that I've been really trying to learn about is to put up boundaries and to not always people please and to say a full on no, which I think was it Zara who did that.
Yeah, she did the talk at the end, didn't she?
So yeah, it's only really been the last couple of years, but you know what? I'm loving it. I really am loving it. I do a bit of life coaching now. You know, I have a life coach and I still have a therapist, and I'm learning so much about myself and really starting for the first time in my life to trust who I am and that I'm on the right path. I like getting older. I don't look back and regret. There's a lot of things I could regret. I didn't get to do the, you know, the traveling. I didn't get to do the backpacking. I didn't get to go to university. I didn't get to do the mad, you know, teenage holidays.
Mm.
But all of the stuff that I went through has made me who I am today, and I can do what I want with my life now.
Yeah. What tips would you give to people listening on how to kind of enjoy the moment that you've learned going through all that? Because I had a bit of a, I had a miscarriage at Christmas and then a bit of a breakdown in April. Yeah, and I think from that, what I learned was exactly the same as you, but not on a very small scale. It's more like I've learned how to enjoy happiness because I think before I just trundled along and you just get on with it. You take everything for granted, like you say with the Emmerdale stuff. You go with the flow when you're there. And then all of a sudden when something makes you not feel like that, but then you get it back, you start to really realise the power in it and embrace it.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you've got any tips for the listeners on ways that you do take a stop and a reevaluation.
About 2 years ago, I was in a relationship and it was very emotionally abusive. And I found the courage to leave. And when I left, I lost everything.
Mm.
literally lost everything, and there's a lot of stuff I can't talk about because it's still going on, but I was homeless. I financially lost everything, and I really struggled because I was thinking, how have I allowed this to happen? Like, after everything that I've been through and getting Emmerdale and then Holby and being up there, how have I... And I beat myself up so much for putting my heart on my sleeve and my trust in someone. And I really, to the detriment of my mental health, but in the middle of all that, I managed to find the strength to leave. My point is, in the aftermath of that, like you were saying about how the miscarriage happened, and then about 5 months later, you really were like...
Mm.
And it was kind of the same thing. About 3 or 4 months after that, my anxiety was just going through the roof. When you're financially unstable, that's not going to help. Mm. But I was worrying about worrying about worrying. And one of the things that I did, and I encourage anybody else to do, when things are starting to go, when you can feel that your mindset isn't working so much, is to get help. That's one of the biggest pieces of advice. And it's very easy for me to say it because I know myself so well in terms of therapy and what I need, because I've done every single bit of therapy going. I don't know what in those 13 years. But my point is that still being able to just stop and to just take a breath and go, right, I can't do this on my own.
Mm.
I need therapy again. And that's exactly what I did. And I picked up the phone and I sought out some therapy, and I started to work through everything that I felt from that bad experience, but also started to realise that, like you just said, I still didn't know who I was. Mm. So no wonder I got into this situation where I was just trying to please this person and adhere to everything that he wanted and to serve him.
Mm.
No wonder I just went along with all these decisions that were being made that I couldn't even stop to think about, because I didn't know who I was. So, yeah, one of the biggest pieces of advice is to seek help and to not feel ashamed to have therapy again, because it's been the best thing that's ever happened. But the other thing that really struck me recently is, and it was something that Carl had spoke to me about as well, the guy that I've been wonderfully introduced to and having some life coaching with, was how don't take life so seriously. When I was like talking to him and I was like, oh, but I'm worried about this and this and this and this, and then that happened last night and I did this talk and I'm not quite sure how it was received, and then he's like, mate, stop taking yourself so freaking seriously. And I just went, excuse me, what? But then I was like, oh my God, he's so right.
Yeah, it's liberating, isn't it?
It is. And obviously I'm trying to do these talks and, you know, tell people that life isn't an emergency, it's an adventure. But yet I'm on this constant emergency button going, and I'm like, stop pressing it.
Mm.
Like, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So it's kind of just being able to take the moment and, you know, to not always walk past the park and not get on the swing.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, to do something for yourself every now and again that, you know, you wouldn't normally do. Like, you're the same as me in many ways. And a lot of people out there at the moment, there are so many browsers open.
Yeah.
Like, in our mind and on our laptops, yeah, and on our phone, and so many apps going off. Like, how about just going, I'm just going to go and have a glass of wine and a think, yeah, and a breath. And I'm just going to go and have a walk.
Yeah.
I'm just going to do something for me. So I think that's really important.
What's your thing for you? What do you do? Is it a glass of wine and a walk? Or
Do you know what? I'm really bad at taking time out for me.
Mm.
I'm good at taking time out for me when it means going out and seeing friends.
Yep.
Like, I'm good at taking time out for me when it means taking Ruby, my little pup, out for a walk. But in terms of, and I've really had to start doing this on tour actually, because it's just me. I haven't got my little baby girl Ruby. Mm. She's with mum and dad in Hull. God, I miss her. And I haven't got all my circle of friends around me. And there are some times when I'm in digs and, you know, I'm doing all my work for Seed and I'm doing my public speaking and I'm like, right, what I need to just stop. I can't go to the pub for a glass of wine because I've got a show to do at 7:30. So I can't, that's not an option. So I've started to learn a little bit about my self-care. And even if that's just doing a face mask, even if that's just having a binge watch on YouTube of the new Jonathan Groff, because I love musicals. You know, so having like a binge watch of Dear Evan Hansen or Hamilton or, you know, all the musicals that I love, and having a Sutton Foster, a lot of people like watching this will not have a clue what I'm on about, but having a Sutton Foster, you know, massive binge off with it. Like, I love stuff like that and I don't do it enough. Yeah. And you can tell of it because, like,
yeah, you get so animated.
Yeah, and like, and listening to like the new Frozen 2 soundtrack, and you know, like, and then like YouTube's amazing because you start off on one path and then you discover more things. And that's what I'm learning to do: whack on a face mask, watch whatever guilty pleasure of YouTube gleek fest I can find. That's what I'm learning to do to stop and I don't know, to treat myself and maybe go and have a manicure. Like, you know, I'm very ungirly and it's, you know, like, I go on the red carpet so often with like my publicist or my friend will like just go, can you just remove that chip nail varnish? Like, and I'm like, do you maybe want to think about brushing your hair? I'm so bad. Like, I've got full makeup on today because I'm going to the theatre tonight, but normally I'm like, so yeah, that those are little things that I can do, but it sometimes takes somebody to remind me to do it, actually.
Yeah.
You know.
So I'm telling you.
Yeah, you're telling me.
Yeah, I'm telling you this weekend. So in the last part, I really want to talk about Seed because you've had some amazing funding, haven't you, recently? And there's some big plans for Seed. So do you want to tell us, you touched on what it stood for and why it started, but do you want to tell us about it and what it does?
So obviously Seed's been going for 20 years this year, which is amazing. And we've grown way above what we could ever have dreamed. And mum and dad have worked tirelessly with everyone at Seed and the volunteers to make that happen. But we've realised that we needed more sustainability because that we even get GPs sending their patients to us and we're not a clinical practice. This is how underfunded the whole problem is. But what we realised is that we need more money and sustainability to help Seed go in the future. Like, mum and dad have never paid themselves a salary. And I can say this because we all know how charities work, and it's vital that people in those charities get on the payroll and get a wage. Like, it's the only way it can work. So I've been working very hard to try and get more sustainability in so that we can employ somebody to take over mum and dad's. That's the one thing. But the other thing was thinking of a model of sustainability for the charity, but also how can we make a difference in schools and get to educate the students before things escalate. So we came up with the idea of the educational toolkit. And the educational toolkit is a resource that mum and I filmed together, and I raised some money at the gala that we did 2 years ago to get everything in place to be able to do it. And we created this 4-lesson plan. And it's a mix of animation, online resource, Gok Wan, Body Gossip allowed us to use part of his series in it, which was just amazing. Facts and figures about what an eating disorder is, what it can escalate to, the need for understanding about the effects on the body, looking into body image and well-being. Like, it's all covered in this lesson plan because teachers are very scared to teach about eating disorders because if you don't know it and understand it, these teachers are under so much pressure at the moment. They say one thing wrong.
Yeah.
And, you know, people come down on them like a ton of bricks. So it's, even though well-being is really high on the agenda at the moment with Ofsted and all schools, it's still very scary place for teachers, and they're under enough pressure with grades and making sure that everything's in the lesson plan. So we've created this toolkit and been trying to get it into schools. But as many people out there will know, getting into schools is a little bit of a conundrum. So I've been Patron of Seed for 9 years now, and when we got the resource out there, we thought it was going to fly, and it didn't. And so Mum and Dad said to me, look, you live in London, you've got more of a connection and network than we'll ever have. You're the one that goes here, there and everywhere. Would you step up and get this toolkit into school? So I started to learn about the world of education. I went to educational conferences. I was very, very fortunate that I was introduced by our mutual wonderful friend Gemma Greaves to the amazing Jazwan Porfar, who is a school teacher and public speaker. And she really took me under her wing to help me see how the world of education works. And getting your foot in the door is a nightmare. And schools just don't have the budget. But it didn't stop me. I kept trying, and I still am trying. But then what happened is with Jazzy's advice, I applied to do TEDx Norwich, and I thought, there's not a cope in hell that I'm going to get it. And I did. And it's not one of those things where everyone thinks, oh, you're off the telly, you can get it. Like, it's not. You have to apply. Mm. And they're really strict. They don't care what background you come from. You've got to have a vision and an idea that you want to share.
It's all about the story, isn't it? It's not about who you are.
Not at all, which I love. Mm. I also started doing a lot of talks everywhere that I could. And all of these things started to come together. And I did a talk at the ones with Chambers of Commerce. And LinkedIn's been amazing, and networking has been amazing, because all of these different people that I have met and the opportunities that I've had have just been unreal. But I did a talk at the Chamber of Commerce, and at that talk, aside from the wonderful CEO, Steve Pinter, I love him, Steve, I love you, I was in front of an audience, and a woman called Sandra Hutchinson was there, who was a former teacher, but also massively now worked in mental health. And she had a very strong connection and was married to Simon, who worked at the Goldsmiths. And she was so moved and touched by my story that she very kindly introduced me to Simon and the idea of applying for one of their grants. And after many blood, sweat and tears of applications and filling out of forms and going to Goldsmiths and talking to them about the educational toolkit and the idea of them sponsoring the toolkit and helping me get the toolkit into schools, because I was struggling so hard to find schools who had the resource. Mm. They amazingly gave us a grant to put a number of the toolkits into schools, predominantly to start with in the Hull and East Riding area and the London area. Mm. And to use that grant to obviously get it out there as best we could, give it as a free resource to schools, but also to collect the data, to show sort of all the facts and the figures and the research needed, so that we then have something to produce, to give to other schools, to go, look, this is what this resource does. And to other companies and corporates, because there's the big CSR box out there that needs ticking, and I know it does, and somebody's got to see that seed is the one for them, because the work we do saves lives, and Goldsmiths have given us this amazing opportunity to get this resource out there. But then alongside of that, I was looking at doing the gala again, because I didn't do it last year because I just... there wasn't enough hours in the day, quite frankly. And, I was still getting on my feet after everything that had gone on 2 years ago. So last year was all about me just on this mission. And now this year, I'm still on the mission. It's all coming together. And I stupidly decided I was going to do the gala again. Because that's just,
I've just not got enough to do.
But I really wanted to celebrate Seed being 20. I have learned a lot since the last gala, and I've met a lot more people that are willing to, the generosity of help and support for Seed. You know, even you asking me to come on today and talk about us has been amazing. But because Goldsmith had given us the grant, Simon suggested that would we like to do the gala at Goldsmith's at the hall, which is, you don't get to go there unless you're invited. Wow. And it is amazing. It's on a different level. Like, I can't even begin to explain just the beauty of that building and the history and everything. So, the gala's happening on November the 18th. But, of course, with putting on a gala, I need sponsors. I need help. So yeah, that's where I'm at the moment in terms of, you know, just starting to approach companies who might be willing to sponsor the event, because obviously I can't make this happen for free, we all know that. So it's about sort of getting the resource around us to be able to put on an amazing event that we know we can, with the hope that that will then generate money from the auction, from the donations on the night, from the tickets. So yeah, so that's coming up on November the 18th. So if anyone is out there who wants to help, oh, hi. That's the thing, like I have a lot of amazing connections, but like in terms of brands and stuff like that, it's totally out of my remit. You know, I don't know where to start with all of that. So any help is always much appreciated. But the idea of the night is to celebrate 20 years of Seed. Hopefully generate enough resource to keep doing the amazing work that we're doing and to expand Seed to a point where mum and dad, you know, can take a back seat because they're not well. And I want my mum and dad around for as long as possible.
Of course.
Yeah.
I just want to say thank you so much for being so open and honest.
Thank you.
I think it's incredible that you've used something that is so traumatic and hard and life-changing to help the lives of others, and what you're doing with Seed is just so incredible, and your parents being so involved in it still, and just putting what you went through as a family but using that to help so many other people is inspirational.
I get emotional because I just think you know, I always say you can grow flowers where dirt used to be, but if we can just help save and it's not even just if the adventure stops for somebody with an eating disorder in terms of actually physically not being alive, but the adventure stops in all senses of their life. And I speak in front of kids around the country, in schools around the country, and I can't have any of them go through what we did. So I'll keep going on about it. Yeah. Until the cows come home.
Yeah, it's such an inspiration. It's got me going. We're both crying.
Sorry.
but yeah, thank you so much.
It's, and you're amazing too. Thank you.
Thank you.